Hit it. The president wants to spy on 200 million Americans without a warrant. Has he read this document, which he was sworn to uphold?
Now, I will not have you libel Abraham Lincoln.
I don't understand the problem with registering guns. We register cars.
Mark Levine brings you the news the government doesn't want you to know.
Today, an explosive story about connections between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists.
When there's a conflict between Scalia's conservative values and the Constitution of the United States, he throws away the Constitution.
And we do have secret prisons. That is not what America's all about.
Let's go to Mark in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. The President of the United States is in Turkey today, a very important symbolic move. On his first significant overseas trip, he is visiting a predominantly Muslim country that is a secular democracy. This fresh from a very successful visit at the G20 in Europe, where it appears that both Barack and Michelle Obama got high marks across the Atlantic. Elsewhere, outside of Europe and the Middle East, we have a new problem, that of North Korea, a renegade country that was allowed to obtain nuclear weapons under the last president, George W. Bush, has now shot a missile over one of our strongest allies, the nation of Japan. Here at home, the recession continues, with Barack Obama taking some pretty harsh stances against auto companies and his Treasury Secretary as well. But there are green shoots in the economy, not just in stocks rallying, but also in businesses putting in orders for durable goods, going up for the first time in 6 months. In Iowa, the state has become the third state to allow gay people the equal right to marry that their straight citizens enjoy. And there's conflict in the Palin family between Governor Sarah Palin and the boy that she was going to force to be her son-in-law, a guy named Levi. We're going to talk about all these issues and any issue on your mind. All you have to do is call in the toll-free number, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. To discuss these issues, I'd like to invite every couple of weeks someone who disagrees with me to get a perspective different from my own, and I think no one does that better than my good friend Mike Lane. He's a Republican strategist and a frequent guest on the Inside Scoop. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Mark, for having me back. I look forward to tonight's discussion.
Let's start with Turkey. It's, I think, very important that President Obama promised to visit very soon in his tenure a predominantly Muslim nation. He has now done so. He is there now. And there's no better country to do that than Turkey. Turkey is a secular democracy. Turkey proves that you can have a predominantly Islamic nation that is a secular democracy, and thus, I think, serves as a model to Muslim nations worldwide, both as a reaching out to show that America does not hate Islam, does not hate 1 billion Muslims around the world. And frankly, America's America's esteem has been pretty low in Muslim countries. I think even you will have to agree that was a brilliant move on his part.
Well, I don't know if it's brilliant. It's probably an okay move, a good move. I mean, I certainly can't criticize him for going there. There's nothing wrong with attempting to have better relations with the Muslim world and all the Muslim countries and things like that, Mark. But the question is, what is going to come out of it? I mean, the last 10 days we've been on a foreign policy roll. The president's been out of the country. He's been meeting with this foreign head of state, that foreign head of state. And so far, including the meeting with Turkey today, it's been all show and no substance. And I look forward to some substance, if not now, somewhere down the road coming out of it, because we don't have a lot to show of it as of right now.
Let me suggest to you that sometimes a show can be substance. That sometimes it is important for the President of the United States to show the rest of the world that we don't hate them, that we're willing to work with them. One of the things that I liked in addition to his visit to Turkey was when he was in England and France, he did something that I don't believe any American president has ever done before in American history. You can correct me if I'm wrong. He had town hall meetings in foreign countries before French audiences and German audiences. He had no holds barred questions. They could ask him anything he wanted, and with translation, he answered them. That's an extraordinary thing, because I think he's actually going above their democratic heads of state directly to the peoples of these countries, whether it's France or Germany or Turkey. I hope he does this in Turkey as well, which is great, because those countries are democracies. We may disagree with those countries' leadership, but we will support those countries as democracies. He's going above their heads.
Well, you know, Mark, during the campaign, he went to Germany and gave a speech, and he was widely ridiculed and panned for that as, what was he running for, President of the United States, or was he running for President of Europe or President of the world? These town hall meetings overseas strike me as the same thing. I mean, what's the point? He's not, you know, I mean, there's not a problem, but a president only has so much time in a day, and holding a town hall meeting with a group of foreign citizens who essentially, as far as our interests are concerned, don't count. No, they don't count.
England and France don't count far as American interests are concerned?
The heads of state count, but the citizens' opinion doesn't count. It's the heads of state. And he's not accomplishing anything. He's out there, on campaign mode one more time. What is coming of these things? How is it in the United States' interest for him to hold a town hall meeting in Germany and France? And the answer is, it's not. He's not doing anything wrong. It's just that he's not accomplishing anything. It's all fluff and no stuff.
I actually think he's accomplishing a great deal. I mean, I remember you're arguing 2, 4, 6, and 8 years ago. Well, maybe I didn't know you 8 years ago. But you were arguing during the Bush administration that public opinion around the world doesn't matter. Who cares what the French think of us? Who cares what the English think of us?
Who cares
what the Muslim nations think of us? I firmly believe it is important, particularly in democratic nations, even frankly in undemocratic nations. If peoples don't like us, they tend to turn to terrorism. I don't believe that the number of terrorists is fixed, that you kill so many and there's only so many left. I think new terrorists are created every day. Goodwill is important. It is a tangible thing. It matters. To say that if America does something that the French disagree with, the French government disagrees with, if the people of France like our president, we're more likely to get our way. That's how democracies work.
Well, you know, Mark, I don't know. It seems to me we've got a plethora of problems that are here. Many of our problems have gotten much worse since President Obama has been inaugurated, certainly since he's been elected. The economy, as you mentioned, has a couple green shoots, but by and large, we still have a long way to go. He said he was going to focus like a laser beam on the economy, and instead he's campaigning for the presidency of the European Union or something like that. Now, I got bad news for him. The fix is in. Tony Blair is going to get that job. He's going to be president of the European Union. It's time for the president to come back here and focus on our domestic problems and see what we can do about getting our economy on track, getting jobs for Americans who are out of work and want to work, saving people who are, you know, about to become homeless because they can't pay for their mortgages. Those are the things that count, not town hall meetings in France.
Mike, sometimes I think that you're determined to find fault in anything our
current
president
does. It's
he was invited
benign.
To the G20 meeting.
Right.
These are important economic meetings that allow the country's 20 largest economies mm-hmm. to coordinate, to do things like stimulate their economies, to decide,
they decided not to do.
Well, no. France and Germany are stimulating their economy, perhaps not as much as we're doing, but they are working together. They're making sure that trade barriers are low, which I'm sure you support. I know you don't support protectionism. Are you arguing that President Obama should not have gone to the G20 meeting?
No,
that he shouldn't have had a couple town halls while he was there?
No. Of course you go to the G20 meeting. It's an important, it's more of a networking thing than a policy or a procedure, or not a procedure, a policy or a productive meeting this particular time around, perhaps because he's brand new. I'm not going to criticize him for coming home empty-handed from the G20, but you know the White House did a great job in advance of lowering expectations, and they met the low expectations.
What you seem to be saying, though, is that symbolism doesn't matter. That it doesn't matter that Turkey, which used to have a 12% of opinion rating of the United States of America, now has a 60% opinion rating. That England and France, which had opinions of America in the 20s and 30s, are now in the 70s and 80s. You seem to be saying, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike Lane, that it doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks of us. Are you really saying that?
I am saying it's more important that you be effective and that you represent and advocate for United States interests than you win a rock star popularity contest.
And what I'm saying is that when you win those popularity contests, it helps you down the road in putting forward American interests. Obviously, that's yet to be seen, and we'll see what happens.
Right, we'll see.
But I think you
will
see.
It hasn't been productive yet.
He's been in office, 70 days? 75 mm-hmm. days? I think you will see down the road that this has been productive, that reaching out to the peoples of Europe, which after all is an economy as large as our own, the European Union put together, at reaching out to the Islamic world through their secular democracy, Turkey, rather than, you know, George Bush reached out to Saudi Arabia all the time. It's very important, I think, that Barack Obama is reaching out to the democracy in the Muslim world rather than the dictators that control the oil supply. I think that's a very, very important distinction. It will pay us benefits down the road.
We'll see what comes out of it. I remain skeptical.
Well, let me ask you this. There is one country that is not a big fan of Barack Obama. It's not a big fan of the United States. It's not a big fan of, I don't know, practically any country on earth. That country, of course, is North Korea, whose dictator Kim Jong-il just shot a missile, an inter-ballistic missile. Whether it's intercontinental or not, I'm not sure. It did land in the Pacific Ocean. It went over the nation of Japan. The second largest world economy, of course, is Japan. I don't know, China may be fighting them for that these days. but it is a powerful ally. Ever since World War II, Japan has been not only a democracy and an economic powerhouse, but has been a complete, practically a pacifist nation, has not been militaristic since World War II, and is a great ally of the United States. Let me suggest to you that George Bush put Barack Obama in a real pickle when he allowed North Korea to get nuclear weapons during his presidency. And now Barack Obama has a very difficult choice in knowing how to punish North Korea.
Well, Mark, as you know, I have argued before that North Korea actually developed their nuclear weapon on Bill Clinton's watch, not on George Bush's watch.
I don't know if you have any evidence of that, but we'll talk about it.
But you know, that aside, you know, you're in a situation now, what do you do? The first thing is, I would have shot down that missile. Why in the name of anything did we let the Koreans launch that missile and let it go to fruition? Shoot the missile down, knock the bully down in the schoolyard, and show him that he can't get away with these tactics. I mean, this Kim Jong-il guy, he's a very bad character. He's probably psychologically deranged. He's probably suicidal. We know he's certainly genocidal in the way he wants to approach the world. And it's time to just shoot that missile down, and I don't know why we didn't do that.
Well, look, I mean, one of the problems, and listen, I'm certainly not going to defend Kim Jong-il. In fact, it's my argument that George Bush made a terrible error in allowing him to get nuclear weapons. As you recall, under Bill Clinton, there was a treaty that Republicans condemned.
But it didn't work.
During that time, all while Bill Clinton was president, there were not only UN observers watching them in their nuclear facilities, but there was a camera that was there and watching everything. The IAEA was monitoring everything. They had regular inspections. You may recall that as soon as George Bush decided to invade Iraq, North Korea, no doubt with its I don't know whether he's insane, but I do know he's an evil man. I don't think he's, you know, when you say mentally deranged, that suggests that he's irrational. I don't think Kim Jong-il is irrational. I think he is a rational dictator trying to achieve as much power as possible. That may be evil, but it's not crazy. In any case, he saw that our attentions were focused on other things. He went and threw the UN inspectors out. George Bush did nothing. Now he has a nuclear warhead, and soon he may be, I think perhaps already, he can drop it on Japan. Soon he may be able to reach Hawaii. On the issue that you raised, shooting down the missile, one of the things that unfortunately we learned back when Saddam Hussein was shooting Scuds over Israel is that our anti-missile technology is imperfect. Maybe it's better now, but as I remember the Patriot Arrow missiles, what it would do is it would shoot up at one projectile and it would come down as four projectiles. And so suddenly you would take a payload that's dangerous and make it into four dangerous payloads. You know, when you shoot a missile down, Mike, it's not like Space Invaders where it bleeps from the screen. There are still things up in the air that come down. I don't think we have the technology, did we? Do you think we have the technology to shoot North Korea's missile down without doing damage to Japan?
I think we do, and you don't have to shoot it down while it's over land.
It was over water
for a long time.
No, that's a point.
This is a missile that, let's not talk about Hawaii, this is a missile that can reach Alaska. I understand we'll get to that topic at the end of the...
Sarah Palin, but that's a different topic.
End of the discussion.
I dislike Sarah Palin, but I don't wish any missiles to rain on her home. I want to be clear on that.
What did Bill Clinton do? Bill Clinton negotiated and, you know, he signed a treaty or an agreement, not
an
a
agreement,
treaty.
An agreement.
He signed an agreement with North Korea that, you know, if you're a good guy, then we'll give you all this aid and stuff like that, and we'll all be pals for now and again.
We weren't pals.
Hang on. Bill Clinton was made a fool of. George Bush went along the same lines. He reached an agreement. He was, you know, North Korea's going to be a good guy, and we're going to give them all kinds of aid. They made a fool of George Bush. They're going to make a fool of Barack Obama if he doesn't stand up to them.
I'll tell you, we're running out of time, but I want to get back to North Korea and also get to your calls. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
This year, 28,000 Americans will be diagnosed with oral cancer. Every year, 7,000 Americans die of oral cancer.
I'm Eva Cohen, and I'm an oral cancer survivor. I didn't fit the profile. I didn't smoke or drink. I had no family history of cancer. No family history of cancer. I was 31 years old. 31 years old. I went to see my dentist about a sore in my mouth that wouldn't heal. It was oral cancer. I had to have a radical neck dissection and a portion of my tongue reconstructed. I didn't know if I was going to live or die.
I'm Surgeon General Richard Carmona. The survival rate for oral cancer is only 50%. Oral cancer can happen to anyone. If you have a sore or lesion in your mouth that doesn't heal within 2 weeks, see your dentist. Early detection is the key.
Early detection saves lives. I know.
One in eight Americans goes hungry. One idea helped change that. A community started a garden that blossomed into farmers markets. One in six children lives in poverty. One group of women found an answer by opening a daycare center that their neighbors could afford. Today, 36 million Americans live in poverty. But one by one, people are helping themselves and each other to change the picture of poverty to one of hope. For easy ways you can help, visit povertyusa.org.
Two words for you. Pop quiz. Ready? Name any funny movie. A drama. Name a mystery. And one more thing. Name the movie your kids saw today in science class.
Know what really matters. Know about your kid's school. And know about your kid. Find out 100 ways to know more, do more.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. President Barack Obama has received his first international challenge. It's not from the place you might think it would become, from Iran or Russia or China, but from the dictator of North Korea that seems, I think, to be worried that the United States isn't paying him enough attention. So like a petulant five-year-old, he's saying, we have power too, we have nuclear weapons, we're gonna shoot a warhead over Japan. Problem, of course, is that those they didn't shoot the nuclear warhead, excuse me. They shot a missile that perhaps could one
carry
day carry a nuclear warhead. And they claimed that, no, this is part of our space program, which no one believed. But China and Russia are using that fig leaf of an excuse to deny any kind of effective action in the Security Council. Maybe we could have shot down the missile, Mike, over the water. I don't know. Japan didn't seem to want us to. They were ready to shoot it down if it appeared over their land. In my view, Japan is most at risk. Obviously, I worry about Alaska, perhaps Hawaii, but Japan would be clearly the country most at risk. It seems to me if they wanted us to shoot down the missile, we should have, but there's no indication that they did. Shouldn't we defer to Japan on the end?
No, I think we run our foreign policy. I don't think Japan runs our foreign policy, and I think that every time North Korea shoots a missile, whether it's successful or not, and this one appears not to have been successful, they learn something by their mistakes.
You said appears not to have been successful. The first one exploded in a minute. This one actually went over Japan in the Pacific Ocean.
Right, right.
Why is that not successful?
Because it didn't go the 3,500 miles that it was supposed to.
All
it
right.
crashed into the ocean
before it could hit like Hawaii.
It was it took a swim long before it was supposed to. Look, we run our foreign policy, not Japan. It's up to President Obama to stand up to the North Koreans and tell them this is unacceptable. I guess it's okay, you know, for him to stand there and demand an immediate meeting of the Security Council of the United Nations. It's one of the steps you have to do, and he did that. And the Security Council thumbed its nose at the president, and, you know, Russia issued a statement that said, well, we have to study this and see if maybe there were any UN resolutions that might have been violated. And China clearly, you know, approved this launch in advance. I mean, North Korea doesn't do anything without China's say-so. So, okay, you refer it to the Security Council, you get one meeting, they thumb their nose at you the way they did, and now it's up to the president to take the next step of action. And what is that next step of action? You know, he said during the campaign that in the first year he was going to sit down mano a mano with the head of North Korea and you know, have it out. Well,
but to be clear, what he said is he would be willing to sit with the leadership of any country.
Right.
If Kim Jong-il doesn't want to sit down with us, President Obama can do about it.
If Kim Jong-il says, no, I'm not meeting with the president, then I understand that. But he said that in the first year he was going to sit down, Kim Jong-il willing, and go at it mano a mano and find that common ground. I think that would be a huge mistake, but he's on record as committed to it. We'll see what he does.
Look, I mean,
he's got to stop this. You can't let them develop the technology to make these rockets work, because if they do, then they'll be able to hit the United States with nuclear warheads.
I firmly agree that I don't want them to develop this technology. I agree with you. But let me suggest to you that once George Bush allowed them to make nuclear weapons, you know, our hands are kind of tied. Look, I don't like Russia, and I don't like China either. I think Russia, which started to become close to democracy, frankly, again, under President George Bush, was allowed to go back. I think Russia's taken a huge backstep from going from Yeltsin to Putin and his, you know, protege Medvedev, who is just a figurehead for Putin. Mm-hmm. But there ain't nothing we can do about Russia other than things like helping to promote democracy. China's the same way. In fact, China in many ways controls our economy because, I would argue again, the mistakes of the last administration, China holds all of our debt. I don't like that Russia has nuclear weapons. I don't like that China has nuclear weapons. But they are dictatorships. They are very powerful. There's nothing we can do. Once George Bush allowed a dictatorship, North Korea, to have these nuclear weapons, he kind of tied our hands. I mean, the next thing you know, Kim Jong-il could be threatening South Korea. They're just across their border. It's, you know, it would become the third dictator in the nuclear nation. I think it's probably already there, the third nuclear dictatorship. And it makes options for Barack Obama very, very limited.
Okay, Mark, I'm not going to go back and revisit the argument that they developed the nuclear weapons in Korea during Clinton's watch.
During
Clinton's watch. I mean, I stand by that. You stand by yours. But you know what? It's Barack Obama's presidency. It's his time to move, and it's his time to make decisions. He asked the country to make him president, and they did. Now it's his time to
what
to
is
act,
shooting down
and
the missile accomplished?
You can't go back and say, okay, well, gee, I wish President Clinton or President Bush hadn't left me this mess. No.
Should we announce that we're going to shoot down every missile from North Korea from henceforth?
He asked for this. I would think you would do it on a case-by-case basis. You don't have to necessarily make a blanket policy, but we know when they're going to shoot one. They have to prepare the test site. We know when it's going off, and if it is in our interest, as I believe it was this time, to shoot down that missile before it had the chance to go its full flight and give them the opportunity to learn from their mistake, then, yeah, I think it's shoot them down.
Well, you know, that's a high-risk strategy, let's face it, because Kim Jong-il could do lots of things. He could say, if you shoot us down, that's a declaration of war. We're going to use all the power we have. We're going to go after South Korea. You might have another Cuban Missile Crisis-like event. Is it worth it for him over shooting this missile to create what could be a horrific war? I mean, this is a huge risk to take.
Okay.
You're willing to take that risk.
First of all, Kim Jong-il said that there was a satellite on this thing that they were trying to put into orbit.
Right,
which was
not
his excuse. Now,
right.
Do we believe this guy? No, we don't believe him.
There was
no satellite involved.
No.
I say better to risk the conflict now than after they develop the certain technology of knowing how to make these missiles work. Because once they develop the certain technology where they can, with 99.9% confidence, hit Alaska and possibly Hawaii with these missiles, then it's too late. I say, let's not let them develop the technology.
Don't you think if Japan and South Korea, the two nations most threatened by North Korea, wanted us to shoot that missile down, we would have done so? I think it's pretty clear. I was reading what the Japanese Prime Minister was saying, and he was clear that if the missile were to land anywhere in Japan, they would shoot it down. They have the technology themselves that we have provided for them.
Right.
But I did not hear anything, and I suspect about the Japanese or the South Koreans wanting us to shoot down the missile, and I suspect behind closed doors they were telling us not to.
You're right.
Because they fear for their own lands. These are democracies. They are in peril, and they've told us that they don't want us to act in this way at this time. They do support sanctions. They support, and I support sanctions too, and I assume you do as well.
You know, there comes a time when sanctions wear out their welcome. We have sanctions now. They're not working. We're not going to get any more sanctions because Russia and China won't allow any more sanctions because China issues a statement that says, well, now let's not get too hot and bothered about this whole thing. You know, we really ought to ratchet down the blood pressure here. Look, the difficulty, as you stated, is Kim Jong-il suggested in advance that if Japan shot down this missile, he would consider that to be an act of war. Okay, well, let me ask you this. What was the fact that he violated Japan's airspace and shot the missile over their country? Was that an act of war? It seems to me it is, and it seems to me that the more you let this little punk, you know, take center stage, the more difficult he's going to be. And if you can deal with him sooner rather than later, you're better off. It may not be clean, it may not be neat, and there may be a price to pay for dealing with him today, but I think it's a lot smaller price than dealing with him tomorrow or the day after.
Well, Mike, I'll meet you halfway. I will agree with you that he's a very dangerous man. I will agree with you that North Korea is a very dangerous country. I do think we have to take what steps we can. I like the idea, though, of starting with shooting down a missile is a very aggressive action. I would start with less aggressive actions and move up. You know, he's gone to Security Council. The Security Council tells him no. Perhaps he should announce that the next missile, or Japan should announce. I think it'd be better coming from Japan. After all, they're the nation most directly threatened. They should look out for themselves. Maybe they should announce the next missile will be torn down. But you have to realize it's a huge gamble. It's a huge gamble. We have decided, because Russia and China have nuclear weapons, that we don't mess with them. We don't shoot down their missiles. We don't shoot down their tests. That doesn't mean we like Russia or China. We don't like the dictatorships, but we understand, unfortunately, they're too powerful to mess with. You and I both agree that we should try to prevent Iran from ever developing a nuclear weapon. But once a country develops a nuclear weapon, let's face it, the options are circumscribed. It's very risky now to mess with it.
Okay, there's also the fact that under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Act and et cetera, there's, you know, sort of a grandfathering of the nations that already have them.
That's true.
You know, it's North Korea that's trying to come out of the box and trying to do something. I don't think you equate the way you would treat North Korea with the way you would treat China or Russia.
And, but the point is, they have joined, and admittedly not something that you or I wanted, they have joined the nuclear fraternity. Admittedly, they start out small. Russia and China started out small as well. They have joined it. They are not a democracy. I don't really have much of a problem with democracies having nuclear weapons. For example, India or Israel or even South Africa today after apartheid. I think when a democracy is in charge of nuclear weapons, it's a very different thing. Kim Jong-il scares me. And I would hope that secretly right now the CIA is working on trying to depose this guy. I think you would agree.
Oh,
that,
absolutely.
That would be a terrific thing to do. But while he's in power, you know, and maybe when he dies, there'll be a chance to do something then. I don't know. But we've got to treat him carefully. He is a very dangerous man with his finger on a very dangerous weapon. And if he could shoot over Japan, I think he could shoot Japan. And
oh, absolutely. He can hit Japan.
Right. And if he does hit Japan, I mean this is the beginning of something that we don't even want to imagine. In horror. So in some ways, I think Bill Clinton had the right idea. Pay this guy off. Give him $50 million in wheat. It's blackmail. It's horrific. It's awful. But as long as we give him small things and we send monitors in and we make sure he doesn't get more powerful, maybe that's just what we have to do. Right. I don't like it any more than you do. But better than risking a nuclear war.
I'm perfectly okay with the concept of foreign aid if you get what you want. But Korea made a fool out of Clinton. They made a fool out of Bush. We'll see where the president goes. I think it's a mistake, but he said he was going to sit down and talk to this guy. We'll see before the end of the year how that comes out.
I hope he does sit down and talk with them. I hope he gives them a very stern warning, and I hope he goes through with it. But to be clear, you are saying that Japan should have, or us, we should have shot down that missile, even if it meant, as Kim Jong-il said, an act of war. You were willing to take that
risk. It was an act of war to fire it. It was a violation of UN Security Council resolution to fire it. Yes, I would have shot it down.
When we come back, we'll come back home talking about the economy and domestic issues. Please join us, 888-488-MARK.
This is firstgov.gov, where we're obsessed with getting you government information.
Brand new student loan applications on the site, baby.
This calls for a celebration.
Here's your uncle.
So in the end, it was either take the astronaut gig or come work here. What can I say? Duty called.
Dude, that's my cop.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure that's Sam's cop.
Oh, sorry?
Yeah. No. Sam's. No.
Just log on or email us and get what you need.
C, change of address form. That's how it's done.
D, driver's license renewal. Mm-hmm.
E, emailing social security information.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Nice, we'll allow it. All right, Ed.
What are those?
Government surplus cars for auction.
You posted those online last time.
No, you did.
I'm posting them online this time!
For all your government information, firstgov.gov.
Oh, what have we got here? Sometimes you feel tired. You can't seem to lose those extra pounds off your midsection. And your joints hurt when you take the stairs. Well, you're getting older. But I'm happy to say that there's some simple things we can do to keep you happy and healthy for years to come. We can also lower your risk for some serious diseases the older population is often subject to. Proper nutrition is more important than ever. Your body has changed, you know. Not as many treats. a basic exercise plan, lots of walks and fresh air, and most importantly, come and see me for twice yearly checkups to help ensure the best possible quality of life. Now, how does that sound? Good boy.
Improve the quality of life for your elderly pet. Schedule twice yearly checkups that include preventive care and regular lab work. A message from the veterinary members of the American Animal Hospital Association.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I promised you we would get to domestic policy and the economy, and we will, but before we do, there is an important foreign policy issue just announced today, and that is with regard to Cuba. The United States has imposed a complete embargo on Cuba, not just financial restrictions, but even preventing Americans from traveling there, really since Fidel Castro took power in the early 1960s. For the first time in almost 50 years, President Obama is relaxing those travel restrictions. Mike, I think it's a good idea. I think it's about time to do that. The travel restrictions haven't done anything to get rid of the dictatorship that is Fidel Castro. Americans today can travel to Vietnam, they can travel to China, they can travel to Russia. These were restrictions on Americans, not on Cubans. And let me suggest to you that Cuban Americans, who are the most likely people to go and visit Cuba, are the best embodiment of helping to teach American values like democracy so that when Fidel Castro passes away, we have a little bit of inculcating our values and maybe the people of Cuba can finally get a democracy.
Mark, I would probably have waited until after Fidel slash Raul Castro are out of power on this. What are we getting in return? It seems like from the preliminary reports, this is a unilateral action. What we're doing is we're easing travel and investment and financial restrictions on the island. Their economy is devastating. I mean, they're just nowhere. And what we're doing is we're going to be able, with the easing of financial restrictions, we're going to be infusing money into their economy, and we're going to be helping to build their economy and getting absolutely nothing in return for it. I would have negotiated this. I don't think you can get it from either Fidel or Raul Castro. And I would have waited for them to be out of the picture and see who the next leader is. And that's when I would have done this and gotten something in return for it, such as an increase in human rights, an increase in the ability of Cubans to travel, less belligerency towards the United States on behalf of the Cuban government, those kinds of things.
Well, look, I have no problem with sitting down and negotiating with foreign leaders, even our enemies, as you know, whether it be North Korea, Iran, or Cuba. I do hope that Barack Obama does this. I think these are limited steps, the kind that perhaps could lead to a summit whereby we get some things from Raul Castro. But look, let's face it, dictatorships want to stay in power. They don't want to be out of power. They are not going to do anything to help their people if it means throwing them out of power. And that's true whether it's North Korea or Iran or Cuba. So at the same I think when you have a policy that hasn't worked, and I think few would argue that our policy has worked. I mean, we haven't managed to dislodge either Castro brother. We haven't managed to bring any human rights to Cuba. We've had this embargo for 50 years, and what have we accomplished? Are the people of Cuba the least bit freer for it? They aren't. I think that by engaging, by opening up some barriers, we can actually lead to a dialogue. Let's face it, it was the West, largely that dialogue, that brought the old Soviet Union down. And largely, I would argue, the neglect of the West that's building up the dictatorship of Russia to this day. We've tried it one way for 50 years. Why shouldn't we try it another way?
Well, I just don't think you can do it with the brothers Castro. As I said, I'd be willing to negotiate this with whoever replaces Raul or Fidel. I mean, who even knows if Fidel Castro is still alive? I mean, we don't have
Fine.
Any idea.
So Raul Castro.
But I do it with the next one. I just don't think that this is the appropriate regime. They're horrendous on human rights. They just, you know, imprison and enslave their people. It's not the kind of regime with which we ought to be doing business. Let's find a new
one. Again, I'm not defending the regime, but we do business with China. We do business with Russia. We did business with Saddam Hussein. As you recall, Rumsfeld did business with Saddam Hussein. It seems to me that sometimes the best way to affect American policy is actually to do business in a way that helps these nations free up. And I think Vietnam, for example, is a classic example. Here we fought in a horrific war with them. There's no country, perhaps, that has greater reason to hate America than Vietnam. And yet Vietnam is, though still a dictatorship, moving closer to America, to our values, and frankly is very far from a country like North Korea.
Mark, I think you assign a unity to Vietnam that doesn't exist. The South Vietnamese are still very appreciative of what we did. They still reject and resent the fact that North Vietnam has taken them over, taken away their democracy, taken away their way of life. It's still two countries over there, even though the North Koreans rule it like a dictatorship. When we negotiate with China, you know, when Nixon first went to China and negotiated with them, and we sent them wheat, we got things in return for it. We got them to start opening up a little bit. We got an increase in world trade. We got them to agree to some limited human rights improvements as a first step. And then, you know, they move further.
They backtracked, and there are no human rights improvements.
But we get nothing for what we've done with Cuba. So I would just prefer to make some sort of quid pro quo rather than just unilaterally giving them what they want.
I think where we disagree, it's just basically a question of diplomacy. Neither of us like these dictators. All of us would like to see them out of power. In fact, Iran, just a few weeks ago, I was looking forward to the election because Khatami was going to run again. No pro-American Khatami, but far, far better than the very dangerous president they have now, Ahmadinejad. And of course, now he's not running, which suggests to me that the Iranian leadership is digging in. And basically, President Obama reached out to them, they slapped his hand. But I think it's important, even if they slap our hands, that we reach out to them. If we reach out, they slap our hands, and then we take very strong efforts against them. It's a way of showing the entire world, we're not out to get you. We're not just going to invade a country that didn't attack us. We're reaching out, you slapped our hand, then we respond. And I think whether it's North Korea or Cuba or Iran or China or any of these countries, but even what Obama did to the Republicans, you reach out, they slap your hand, they say no, and then you move on, as Obama did with the Republicans, and do it your own way. It's a way of showing people that he's willing to work with them if they're willing to come somewhere in our direction, and if they're not, we'll be strong.
I think it shows a heightened level of naivete, but I'm willing to give him another 30 days of
30 days.
Naiveness.
How about a year?
No, there comes a time when you've got to step up to the plate and be a seasoned professional at conducting foreign policy. And, you know, making offers to Russia and having them slap you down, making offers to Iran and having them slap you down, letting North Korea shoot a missile that
violates, I'm not sure we could have stopped them. I really don't.
I would have shot it down. Don't let them do it.
In moving in domestic policy, there are those that argue that Barack Obama wasn't tough enough with the auto companies. It's really the same kind of argument. Really, all the arguments seem to be he's not tough enough. He's not taking strong stands. Well, this week, President Obama took a very strong stand against both GM and Chrysler, the two auto companies most in trouble in America. He gave GM 60 days to restructure. He made their CEO, Rick Wagoner, leave. He gave Chrysler 30 days to join with Fiat. If not, they're going to face bankruptcy. He was very strong against the auto companies. That you have to praise.
I want to know why he gave them more time. They were told, Mark, they were told when they got the first loans that their clock was up last week. And, you know, they had to come in with a make it or break it plan to survive. And they came in with what everybody in the Obama administration says was a break-it plan. It was not a make-it plan. There's no way GM, Government Motors, was going to survive under that. Chrysler was even more pathetic than that. And President Obama said, well, okay, we're going to move the football ball down the field. We're going to give you 60 more days to come up with this whole thing. No, the deadline was last week. Why are they getting more time? Government Motors ought to be forced into bankruptcy instead of having Barack Obama being president of the largest motor company in the United States. I just don't get why that is. The prescription on Chrysler, I mean, is there a worse run automobile company in the world than Fiat? And so now all of a sudden, you know, we're going to bring Italian quality for Fiat into the United States and make them merge with Chrysler as a condition of keeping them alive? No. Bankruptcy is the way to go. We shouldn't have given them the extension. Let's just stop it now.
Well, to be clear, you recall that it was the last president, George Bush, that first aided the auto companies
right.
when they were in trouble.
Which he should not have done.
And the reason he did it is because the auto companies are a major part of the American economy. You're not willing to give 30 or 60 days to a company that employs perhaps 1 out of 20 Americans, when you include not just the factories, but the distributorships and the dealerships and all. I mean, there's a lot of subsidiary businesses.
Suppliers.
Supply. Yeah. It's not just cars. It's car parts. It's people who sell cars. It's a very, very large portion of our economy and practically the whole economy in the state of Michigan. Before we throw it away, it seems to me, we have to give them a chance to make it work. Now, Fiat does make the kinds of cars that we need for the future, hybrid cars, energy efficient cars, the kind of cars, let's face it, Chrysler and GM and Ford should have been making years ago and are just starting to make right now. What I think the president is doing is he's giving these companies a chance without going into bankruptcy. And then if they do go into bankruptcy, at least they are prepared for the future. It's no big harm. Let them, you know, if they go to bankruptcy, I'm okay with that too. President Obama signaled that he's okay with that. But he did something very, very important, I think, in signaling that he's okay if GM goes into bankruptcy. He also signaled that if you buy a General Motors car, the governor of the United States will stand behind that warranty. Why is that important? Because if they didn't do that, not a single American would ever buy a GM car. Why would I buy a car that in 60 days I can't get service on? By doing that, he protected whatever comes out of bankruptcy, if that should happen, a very, very important move. And he signaled, I think, that he's willing to be tough, that he's willing to let businesses fail, that the Bush administration wasn't willing to let AIG fail, they weren't willing to let Bear Stearns fail. Barack Obama is willing to let them fail if they can't succeed. And frankly, 30 or 60 days is a very short time in this economy.
Mark, take out your Constitution. I forgot to bring mine tonight.
I will.
Take it out and show me the clause where it says that the government is allowed to guarantee the warranties on government motors cars. I read my whole Constitution. I didn't see it in there.
A provide for the general welfare?
Yeah.
Look, you are willing to allow to go downhill the largest American manufacturing plant in the country. There is no larger. We don't have big steel anymore. The main thing we've got is cars. And we're going to start producing nothing. All we'll have is these financial instruments that your friends on Wall Street create. Nothing real will be created in America without even giving them a chance to succeed.
We are going to have the same number of cars consumed in this economy, whether General Motors is making them or not. Explain to me how it makes a difference if it's government motors or Chrysler Fiat. You know what Fiat stands for? Remember back in the old days when it was really, really great quality from the Italians? Fiat was fix it again, Tony. You know, I mean.
Well, now you're blaming a company that exists today for its mistakes of 20, 30 years ago.
Why not? I mean, Fiats have no quality to them.
You know, Chrysler,
they're just no quality.
Was it back in the 70s when the Republicans said, let Chrysler fail? They got a loan and they paid it back early. They paid it back before the loan was done. You want to think about it. If GM goes downhill and doesn't survive as a company, and again, I'm okay with letting it go into bankruptcy, understanding that the government guarantees the warranties. If it doesn't guarantee the warranties, the company is dead. Every GM distributorship in America is dead. Every GM supplier is dead. All the suppliers of parts are dead, and you've got millions of people, both current employees of GM and ex-employees of GM, that are going to be on welfare, going to be taking unemployment. That's going to cost a lot more money than giving GM 60 days to succeed.
I don't think they're dead. Again, our economy is going to consume the same number of cars, whether GM is there or not. What difference does it make if they buy Fords?
Talking about consumers. I'm talking about jobs.
Right, but
I'm talking about the people that make the cars, not the people that buy the cars.
If GM makes a million less cars a year, don't you think Ford's going to make a million more cars a year? Don't you think we're going to keep American jobs going?
It's not.
Don't you think we're going to keep American suppliers going? Don't you think Ford's going to expand its dealership network? Don't you think that, you know, is there really a difference between government motors and Honda USA or Nissan USA or
yes,
Toyota USA?
I think this is a company that can be saved. I think that what you do is you simply tell the GM bondholders, you lose. You tell the GM shareholders, you lose. It may require bankruptcy to do that. But the idea that GM can make cars, can sell cars, can do good cars, that can continue. That's how bankruptcy works. And it's fine with me if the bondholders and the shareholders lose out. But I don't want the people working for GM and the people that have worked for GM to lose out. That's millions of Americans. It'd be a lot less expensive to give them 60 days than to put them on the welfare rolls.
And I don't want my government running the largest automobile company in the country. And
do you want your government running the insurance companies? You want them running the banks?
No, I don't.
Your president, George Bush, put us in charge of AIG, put us in charge of the banks, because he allowed these companies to be too big to fail. That's why we're in this, not because we want to be.
And it was a mistake. There's no legitimate reason in retrospect why we should have gotten involved in all that stuff under Bush in the first place. We should have let the economy run its course. We should let the economy run its course now. We're throwing good money after bad.
Let's talk about that after the break.
I don't know where in the Constitution it allows Barack Obama to use tax money.
Let's talk about that after the break. Folks, it's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Right back.
Saving for retirement might be easy for some folk, but for others, it might take a little more work. And for those who haven't started, there are still things you can do to catch up.
Oh, that is good news.
Like getting out from underneath past debt. And don't get wrapped up with high-interest credit cards.
Let's get you some eyes.
Be diversified with your investments. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Your financial goals are not out of reach. The choice is clear. For a happy ending, choose to save.
Everyone with alcohol and drug addiction is in the same boat. With treatment, you can find solid ground. For drug and alcohol information and treatment referral for you or someone you know, call 1-800-662-HELP.
Dude, are you sure you want this tattoo? Because...
just do it!
Some mistakes in life are permanent. Like hearing loss. To learn how to protect your hearing, visit ASHA.org.
You've probably heard about heart disease, but did you know that it's the number one killer of women nationwide? Heart disease claims more lives each year than breast cancer, lung cancer, or strokes combined. But there are steps you can take to protect yourself against it. For more information on how you can prevent heart disease, contact your local American Heart Association or visit their website at www.americanheart.org.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. My guest, Republican strategist Mike Lane, and I are discussing the economy, and we're discussing the government ownership of a number of very significant American corporations. It is unprecedented. It, of course, started in the waning months of the Bush administration. And one of the few things that the Bush administration and the Obama administration agreed on is there are certain companies that are too big to fail. When Lehman Brothers went down, they took a whole bunch of people with them. And the Bush administration decided to save Bear Stearns. They decided to save AIG. They decided to save GM. Mike, I guess you're arguing that Bush was wrong and that Obama should have done a turnabout and should have made all those countries declare bankruptcy, no matter the consequences. If millions are unemployed, if the banks don't have credit, if the depression gets worse, oh well, we deserve it. That's what you're arguing.
In the beginning, I bought into the argument that we needed to preserve the credit markets in order to keep the economy going. We infused a ton of money both through the TARP funds and through the
Federal Reserve.
That has been shoveling money out the door faster than you and I or our audience could even imagine it. And it just doesn't seem to be doing the job. In fact, what do we get for our money? Well, let's look at the $170 billion that we gave to AIG. $60 billion of that went to bail out foreign banks. Why are we doing that? Why can't France bail out their banks? And why can't Germany bail out their banks? Why is the first call on American bailout money to the AIG to bail out foreign banks.
Mike, make a good point.
They have obligations they're going to default on. Default on those.
You make a good point. You make the same exact point that Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner made in hearings last week before Congress. And the point he made was, we don't have the power to regulate insurance companies like we do with the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. When a bank starts failing, they can come in, they can take it over, they can cut out the salaries, they can cut out payments to foreign banks. They can do all of that with banks right now, but this insurance company stopped practicing insurance and went into banking and brokerage and gambling, and we don't have that power, and we should have that power. And he put forward a provision, legislation, to allow us to regulate big insurance companies like AIG, and the leader of the Republicans in the House, John Boehner, declared right away that he was against it, that it was horrific, that we should never give the Treasury Secretary that kind of power. I think he should have that kind of power precisely so that next time this happens, we don't pay off the foreign banks. Who's right, Geithner or Boehner?
Boehner's right. And the reason is we shouldn't have given the money to AIG in the first place. When you make a mistake,
every American businesses are insured by AIG, and you were willing to let them fail.
Okay, so you know what? They're going to go buy a new insurance policy. Some other insurance company will survive, and they'll provide the coverage. There'll be some dislocation. There'll be some pain, some some restructuring and things like that. But I don't want the government company running the largest insurance company in the world. I don't want the government running the largest auto company in the world. I want private industry running this. We're a capitalist society. We're not a socialist society. But yet, oh, we are a socialist society because the government is running all these things. I don't want one person, the Secretary of the Treasury. You know, what Geithner wants is not even a control board or a panel or a commission or anything like that making these decisions. He wants it vested solely in him.
He's talked about the Secretary of the Treasury. He's talked about there could be a combination with the Federal Reserve. Geithner has not said specifically that he needs it to be regulated any one way, but he says it needs to be regulated. There is currently no federal regulation over insurance, none. There are only state insurance companies. Can we agree that there needs to be federal regulation so that no company can be too big to fail? This should never have happened in the first place. Government regulation would have prevented it.
Well, you know, when you say too big to fail, you're talking about antitrust laws and breaking them up and things like that. The problem
not just
with that,
that. Not just that. Antitrust just breaks up monopolies. AIG is not a monopoly. AIG was not a monopoly. There are plenty of insurance companies in America, but it was too big to fail. It became so big that it insures one out of every three American businesses. That was so big that the Bush administration felt that if they failed, our entire economy would collapse. No company should be allowed to be that large. We need more than antitrust laws.
Okay, here's the problem with that, Mark. And I don't know that I'm left or right on this yet. I'm still looking for the answer. But the problem is when you start saying that, you know, they can't be too big to fail.
I'm talking about regulation.
They're too big.
Right.
That means in an international marketplace, the global marketplace that we find ourselves in today, that means that they're too small to compete. Because when you've got state-owned corporations from places like Dubai and Bahrain and things like that, and state-owned shipbuilding companies and that are so huge that money is literally no object to them and they're backed by their own governments, then unless we can be that big and big enough to compete, you know, the oil companies are like that. You can't have, Democrats rail against big oil. If we didn't have big oil, we wouldn't compete in the world marketplace. You've got to be able to control market share.
Bigger does not mean better. There are plenty of American insurance companies that do very well without being that size. We have a caller on the line, though, and I want to get to George from Fairfax before our time is up. George, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. I've got a question for Mike there about the oil companies being so big and being able to exercise so much power. We now are seeing oil prices going back up. Demand is reducing. The bottleneck, yet again, is refineries. The oil companies have monopolized those refineries. That's why the price is $2 a gallon. If the public saw that price back down to something like $1.50 a gallon, that would be one of the things that would stimulate the economy. But I want to just go to one other point that you were trying to make earlier. About if GM, for example, failed. You're saying that if GM failed, Ford would pick up the slack. I own a Corvette. Nobody makes the Kia Corvette or anything like that. They don't make those cars. But the bigger problem is companies from Asia and China. Something like a Toyota van costs the Chinese under $3,000. Who can compete with that?
Well, what are you arguing should be done, George?
Well, I think one of the best things for the car companies is what Harley-Davidson did. They sold the businesses to the employees. Those employees don't get paid enough to own a corporate jet or fly around in a corporate jet. The money could be reinvested back into engineering and doing away with a lot of the bloated middle-level bureaucracy that they have there.
Okay, two good points, George.
Other.
Let me raise both of them with Mike. The first, with regard to oil companies, you know, Mike, it seems that every time spring hits, the trees come out, the cherry trees bloom, the birds start singing, and oil prices start rising. That seems to have happened every spring for the last 5 or 6 years. That's not a coincidence.
Gasoline prices start rising, not oil prices.
And gasoline prices. You're right. Gasoline prices.
The reason is demand for gasoline goes up. Spring is the beginning of the driving season once more. And we haven't built a new refinery for 30 years in this country because of the environmental restrictions and things like that.
Or because oil companies want monopoly power over refineries.
No. You know what? I think the oil companies themselves would love to build a new refinery, and they can't get the permits to do it.
There's some place in the 50 states of America where they can build an oil refinery. I don't think you can argue that in conservative Oklahoma,
EPA,
they're not allowing.
It's not state regulations. It's national regulations. It's federal regulations.
Even under George Bush. Let's deal with the
EPA
second
EPA won't
point.
Let them do it.
Because I think George makes a great point about GM. Throw out the bondholders, throw out the shareholders, employee share ownership plan, ESOPs. Let the employees, the people who have the most at stake, let them run the company. What's wrong with that?
I don't have anything particularly against ESOPs to, you know, as a generic thing. And in fact, I think they're probably pretty good. And if GM wants to go that way, that would be a fine way to do it. Let the employees buy it. Don't let the federal government buy it.
What do you know, George? We finally found a time when you and Mike can agree.
But no, actually, George and I agreed last week on some, or 2 weeks ago on something too. But then he went on to point number two and he lost me. But here's the thing. ESOPs are not always the answer. Look at United Airlines. They went to an employee-owned airline back in the 80s. And the first thing it did was go straight downhill. Look,
I'm not saying ESOPs always work, but I don't think, frankly, the employees could do any worse than the management is doing. I say give them a chance. Thank you for your call, George. I appreciate it. We've only got 3 minutes left. Two quick issues. Let's see if we have time for both of them. Iowa has become the third state to allow gay people the right to marry. I, of course, celebrated. What's wrong with that?
Well, if Iowa wants to do that, I suppose that's Iowa's choice. The Iowa Supreme Court...
Unanimously, by the way. Unanimous decision of one of these.
The Iowa Supreme Court looked at it, and they made their decision for the state of Iowa. Who am I to tell the Iowa Supreme Court what they can and can't do?
Again, we have agreement, a rare but wonderful thing. Let me move on to the last thing. It's kind of snarky, I admit it, but I want to talk about the Palin family. We have Levi Johnston, the putative son-in-law of Sarah Palin, putative, of course, because she announced in the campaign, when they found out her daughter was pregnant, they were going to get married. And, of course, Levi on his website said, I don't want to get married. I don't want to get married at all. His mother-in-law, if she had attained the vice presidency, was going to force Levi and Bristol to get married in a shotgun wedding, a modern sense. Now that she did not win, Levi is free, and he's going on television. And he's saying a number of things. He's saying that that the Palins won't allow him to take the baby away. He can only see the baby while the Palins are there. He says that Mama Palin, Sarah Palin, knew about their children having premarital sex, and of course some of their sex was unsafe. That has to be true because there is a baby involved. Look, kids make mistakes. I'm not blaming Sarah Palin for the mistakes of her daughter. I'm really not. But what I am saying is that if these mistakes can happen in the Palin family, maybe abstinence is not the best policy. Maybe Sarah Palin needs to bring home and practice what she preaches.
Well, you're right. First of all, it is rather snarky. But as long as we're on the subject, I'll address it. Look, there are some traditions that die hard in the Old West. And,
shotgun weddings
are,
You're not defending are you?
It wasn't always the worst thing in the world. No, look, here's this guy, Levi Johnson.
He's an 18-year-old boy.
Here's this guy, Levi Johnson, and all of a sudden, unbeknownst to him, out of nowhere, there's the opportunity, oh man, I might have the chance to marry the daughter of the Vice President of the United States.
He didn't want that marriage.
Of course he was all on top of
that. Oh, you're blaming the victim
and then
now.
Who's the victim here?
I think the kids are both the victim, and they're victim of a policy that says don't teach sex education, don't teach about safe sex, then you end up being pregnant and they say don't have abortion.
When the campaign...
It's their mother's policy that's
When the campaign went south, he decided maybe it wasn't such a good deal. Mark, he knew exactly how to get a girl pregnant when he started this whole thing. Nobody's a victim here. He was careless.
The problem is policies like the one supported by your party lead to results, as happened in the Palin family. Mike,
I don't know what policies you're talking about.
I appreciate
Mark.
It. Tune in next week for another edition of The Inside Scoop.